darkest recesses of Southern California, Tarzana. David!
Yeah! Well, good morning, everybody. I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Studio City, not Tarzana. And it ain't so darn dark. I've been in some dark places, though. I have. Oh, let's see. Let me start with thanking this group. You guys have made this a wonderful trip and a wonderful weekend up here. My girlfriend and I drove up yesterday, and we met with the two Cheryls and Brent and Bill and Carl. And I'm glad I'm sober because I can remember that stuff today. And we had a wonderful dinner and went to a movie last night, got up bright and early, beautiful sunny day. This is just living life. Living life in sobriety. And I get to remember it all. That's cool. That's very cool. So I always start with telling the group my race so that you don't spend the next hour sitting up there trying to figure out what the hell I am. And the way I tell that story is, in 1965, a Irish Catholic girl in Boston went to a party in Saugus, Massachusetts, and ran into an African-American soldier on his way to Vietnam. And they dropped some acid. Here I am. I'm sure they had a few drinks first, but you know, you get the point, right? Right from the beginning, the alcoholism, I don't know if it was alcoholism, but circumstances started to affect my life from day one. First off, that was a problem because Irish Catholic girls in Massachusetts in 1965 didn't come home pregnant. She was 17 years old, and they certainly didn't come home pregnant from an African American man. That just was not going to happen. And so I was born in Somerville Hospital, and from direct family pressure, my mother was forced to put me up for adoption when I was on my fifth day. I was adopted by a wonderful African-American family. I was adopted into privilege. My father was a executive for New England Telephone at the time. My mother was a housewife in the beginning, and they were very successful. My grandparents, both college educated. My father graduated from Wentworth University. My mother graduated from Tufts. So, you know, just really, really squared away people. My grandfather was actually the first African-American chief of the staff of the White House for 21 years. He was a very influential man in the community and, you know, proper and just a family you could really be proud of. My father was an alcoholic, and when I was, before I can ever remember, he decided to go up the street and have an affair with the woman up the street. They had a child, and my parents were divorced right away. So from day one, I never knew them as husband and wife. I only knew them as divorced. And the way my life looked back then, as a young child, is Monday through Friday, I was with my mother, and then on Friday night, my father would pick me up, keep me for the weekend, and then drive me back. And my very first memory in life, this is a great alcoholic story, right? My very first memory in life is a big yellow sign said Cappy's Liquor Store on it. Because my dad would pick me up from my mom's house, and he would go straight to that liquor store. And my dad would buy Schlitz beer and a bottle of vodka. And while we were in the liquor store, he would say things that I notice now played into my alcoholism. We'd go into the store, and he'd say, "Get whatever you want." Now, alcoholics like things like that. That's a good deal to me, right? Get whatever you want. And so back then, they had mixed match sodas, and I would get a case of soda. And every time he had a beer, I opened a soda. And every time he smoked a Terrington 100, I had a candy cigarette. And we went through our weekends, and we were best buds, and life was grand. And I just dreaded the fact that he was going to drop me off Sunday night with my mom, because my mom was a disciplinarian. She said things one time, and then you're ducking. That was just the rules of the house. So what ended up happening was, about 9 years old, my mom took a trip to Dallas, Texas, and came back and announced to the family that she was moving me and her to Dallas, Texas. And this was the first devastating thing that really ever happened to me, because what she was doing was separating me from my father, who let me do whatever I want, right? And I remember the night before we left, my father took me to a place called Revere Beach. And it was the first time I ever noticed his drinking. You know, I always thought Schlitz beer and vodka was the norm. Every place we went, he had a beer between his legs. It was the 70s. That's just kind of how everybody was. You just, you know, there were no seatbelts and all this stuff that, you know, you got now that save your life. You know, you just kind of did what you wanted to do. And that night at Revere Beach, my father got so drunk, he was trying to win me a teddy bear to take with me. And it got so bad that the carnival guy charged him $40 and just gave him the beer, the bear for me to take. And I'll never forget the fear I had driving home with him that night. I had never seen it that bad, you know, but he was losing his best friend. And off to Dallas I went with the drill sergeant, and it was not happy. I was miserable there. I'm an only child. I started isolating at a very young age. I would go into my room. I loved history. And back then, on television, they used to have, all the TV was war stuff. So my heroes were like Rat Patrol and 12 O'Clock High and, you know, all those Baba Black Sheep, all those things were, I was really, really attracted to. And it kind of got me into history, and I would utilize, back then we didn't have phones, we had libraries. I used to take the, you know, go to the library and check out all the books and go back and just sit in my room, because somewhere along that journey resentment had set in. I resented my mother for taking me away from my father, and that resentment soon turned to hatred. And, you know, that poor woman, really, if you've ever dealt with an alcoholic who doesn't like you, you know it on a daily basis. And I put her through hell. There were times, you know, by the time I was 13 years old, I knew that she wasn't going to let me go roller skating on Friday night, so I would hide my clothes in the bushes and go to school, and I just wouldn't come home, you know. And I would take the butt whooping. I knew what was coming, but an alcoholic, I'll take it, right? I got to do what I wanted. Go ahead, knock yourself out. So my life changes in the fact that now I'm spending my school year with my mother and my entire summer vacation with my dad. Now this is good and bad, right? All I got to do is make it to the end of May, beginning of June, and I can get back to Boston. And my dad, very wealthy, very successful, he prided himself on a new Lincoln every year. That was his treat to himself, right? He liked those Mark IV Lincolns. And he would pick me up at Logan Airport, and he'd get in the car, and he'd say, okay, what do you want to do? Anything you want to do. And for the summer, I lived like that. I had no rules. There was no such thing as a curfew. I got in when I got in. I always had money, and at a very young age, my father started passing out around 3 o'clock in the afternoon from his drinking, and by the time I was 14, 15, 16, I was driving him home from the bars. He used to take me with him. Right, this wasn't uncommon back then. Now, I wasn't the only kid in the bar. And we would go down to this place called the Vogue Restaurant. We would have steak tips for lunch, and he would start drinking. And by 2 o'clock, the bartender would say, go ahead and take him out, you know. And I'd take him out, take him home, and I was driving that new Lincoln. I'd put him to bed, and then I figured out some wonderful things, right? Well, he's asleep. He's not going to miss this $50 bill. And he's certainly not going to hear the car start. Right? And I would take the Lincoln. Now, you would think, here's the funny part about an alcoholic. I could go anywhere. I had money in a car. And as soon as I started that car, you know where I headed? Straight for the projects. Bam. Seeking lower companions. Because, you know, when you have money and you have the car, you're the king of the projects, right? And all the little girls like you, and all the guys are looking up to you because you can afford to buy whatever it is you need to buy. And I had a host of fair weather friends, right, that I was really supporting the party on. And, you know, life went on that way, and I wasn't complaining. And inevitably, the day would come back where I would go back to Dallas, Texas. Now, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe in singleness of purpose, so I don't get into the drug log too much. But, you know, like Bill, I liked high-powered sedatives, and, you know, I found myself doing both alcohol and high-powered sedatives. And I, you know, went through life, because in Texas, I didn't have the resources. My mom, by now, was a struggling woman trying to get an apartment. Back then, there was no child support. As wealthy as my father was, I think his child support payment was like $20 a month or some ridiculous thing like that. And he certainly wasn't going to give my mother any money. And so, you know, we were struggling, and I lived in both of these worlds. You know, one of excess and whatever you want, and one of we can't afford that, we can't do that, we're not going to do that. Just night and day, right? And I'd go back to my isolating. The one saving grace that I found when I got about junior high school was football. I started playing football in Texas, and that's a big, huge thing. And again, if you look at the common thread in my story, it's all ego-driven, right? Love ego-driven stuff. And so I started playing football. I found out I was pretty good at it. And, you know, I kind of had my own separate thing. Do you know I never once invited my mother to a game? Not once did she ever attend. Not once did I ever come into the house and say, this is how my day went. Because I was still carrying that resentment from way back. Now, my drinking was a few sips of my dad's beer up to this point. And at the summer of 13 years old, I discovered alcohol. And how that happened was I landed in Boston, and my father took me from one airport, one terminal to the next, and we got on a plane and we went to the Bahamas. And we get to the Bahamas, and he's going to take me to this show. My dad isn't always the most appropriate guy in the world, right? So he says, we're going to this show at the Playboy Hotel. And it was this show called Busting Loose, right? And we go in, and it had curtains like this. And it had red velvet wallpaper. And there were bubbles and boobs and all kind of things going on. And the guy at the door said, I'm sorry, sir, but there's a 3-drink minimum. And my dad's like, well, he's 13. Does not matter. 3 drink. And so I'm a real man. I had 3 Bahama Mamas. And I found the meaning of life in that room. Everything was perfect for me. And you know, right from the beginning, from that very first drunk, I have a thinker, man. I like to think. I like thinking and I like adventure, right? So the next day, my dad, he's still passed out. And I go down to the pool and I realize I don't really need any help getting his drink. And I'm right up there at the stand saying I'll have a rum and coke because I heard that somewhere. And they just gave it to me. And I was like, cool. And later on in that trip, I actually waited for my dad to go to sleep. And then I booked myself on a little private plane, flew to another island, went scuba diving, you know, went snorkeling, flew back, got back to the hotel, opened the door, pops is still passed out, you know. And that was the kind of kid I was. I just started taking things. I just started, you know, I was entitled. I was entitled. This is what I had been taught. And from that point on, from 13 years old till 40 years old, with the exceptions of trying to get sober in AA or treatment facilities, jails, what have you, every chance I got, I drank. I was not one of the alcoholics who tried to control my drinking. I didn't care about that. I just wanted a buzz. And I wanted it right now, as soon as I could, at every single opportunity I could. And you know, I would dust things off for any opportunity to drink. You have a chance to go to this event. Okay, great. My friend will walk down the street and have 2 extra beers in his pocket. Forget that event. I'm not going. I want that beer. I don't have a picker. My choice is always to get the buzz, right? Always to get the buzz. So life goes on that way through my teenage years. I played some high school football. I was looked at by some colleges for a football scholarship, but I was really undersized for... I played free safety, and this was in the days when Eric Dickerson was coming in college, and you know, you're looking at 210-pound running backs coming through the line, and I was undersized to play the position in college, and so they kind of passed on me. And then I started wondering what I was going to do. History had always been a big thing to me. I loved the military, and so at 18 years old, I thought it was a great idea to just join the Army. Now, prior to this, that summer prior to this, me and my father had reached a different pinnacle now. Now, my dad isn't supplying me like he was, not because he stopped doing that, but because I was growing and didn't want to be around an alcoholic. Right? See, when I was younger, it was nothing for me to go out to lunch with him, watch him get drunk so that I could take advantage of the car and the money. But now at 17, I wanted to have a girlfriend, and I couldn't bring a girlfriend over to the house because he was inappropriate. It was embarrassing to watch him pee his pants, you know, walking out of the bar or fall down. He was 6'4" and like trying to get him up was a pain, right? And so now his alcoholism started being a cramp in my style. So I kind of wanted to push him aside. And that, you know, that has been a history, a string until I got sober in my life, is that if I don't have a purpose for you, well, what are you doing here? You know, it's time to go. And at 17, 18 years old, I made a decision. I'm just going to join the Army. And I did. I joined the Army, and I was in tanks. This was 1983. And I went off to boot camp, and I remember my dad, the last thing that I saw, my dad was standing at the door in his boxer shorts giving me the middle finger as I took the cab to Logan Airport to go join the Army. Now, I didn't understand that back then. I was like, whatever. But today I look back and I can imagine the feeling of desperation that he must have had, because his caretaker was leaving. I was the guy who went down to the corner store and bought his beer home now. He wasn't that flashy alcoholic anymore in the new Linking. Now he was that kind of rough looking drunk that just smelled bad all the time and really kind of made a nuisance of himself. And what I also realized today is that all of his friends had stopped coming by. You know, the guys that we used to go party with had long gone, and he was relatively just alone, you know, and it's a sad state of affairs of the alcoholic at the end of his run. Anyway, so I joined the Army, I get to boot camp, and I fall in love. I loved the Army. I loved the Army. And it came really easy to me. First, I could drink like the veterans that had been there for a while, so I was immediately invited into the drinking crowd. And second, I had never met a drill sergeant that had anything on my mother, so I was ready. You know, my mother was, you know, I knew how to make hospital bed corners and do all that stuff long before I joined the Army. So to put a bed together and, you know, do the fall in line and do the strict stuff, that was nothing. I knew how to get the toilet right the first time, right? And I finally found a place where I actually fit in. And back then in the 80s, what the Army looked like was we partied really, really hard. We drank a lot of alcohol. But we also did our job, and we were really, really good at our job. And again, ego-centered. I was in tanks, and I was in a unit called the 194th Armored Division in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And at Fort Knox, Kentucky, this division had its own style. We wore these special tanker boots, and we had a special hat, and we had these yellow kerchiefs that we used to wear around our necks, you know, all flamboyant, and the old cavalry, and, you know, just ego, brainwashing. And it was an amazing thing to live through. I loved it. I spent the next years just doing what we do. I went to work. I did a great job. I got off work, and I started drinking with people who drank just like me. And nothing was wrong. In 1991, I got deployed to the first Gulf War. And our unit was well recognized. We did a great job in the Gulf War, but I got a little banged up there. And when I got back, they weren't going to let me be on tanks anymore. Now they gave me a desk job. And all of a sudden, my drinking showed its face. Like, I had never had any consequences on how much I drank. The worst thing that could happen to me is I get sick one day. You know, no big deal. My buddies would cover for me, and that would be that. But now they wanted me to do this desk job. And I had 9 years in, and the desk job was a lot different than being on a tank. The Army had, like, these really unrealistic expectations of me. They wanted me to be on time. They wanted me to be shaven. They wanted my boots to shine. I'm a combat soldier. You don't mirror your boots. Somebody will see that in the sunlight and kill your butt. So, you know, it didn't make any sense to me. And basically, I got up for my next re-enlistment, and the sergeant in charge said, "Hey, Prentice, you know what? Take your retirement and get out of here. Because the way you're going, you're going to end up in Leavenworth. You know, the officers are noticing you, the people are noticing you, and it's not good. Get out while you can." And I did. And To this day, I didn't know what sobriety was. I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I wish I had that's one of my regrets I'll always live through, is that I didn't finish my 20 years and go on to do something else. But I left, and it became a pattern in my life too. I start things really good, I just don't finish them, right? And so I leave the Army, and me and a friend who drinks like me, we have a brilliant idea. We're going to move to Los Angeles. We're going to move to Los Angeles, and we're going to restore a 1966 Chris Craft yacht. We're going to live on the yacht, on the beach, and we're going to get all the girls, and everything's going to be great. And we come out here, so we bought this boat, sight unseen, right, for $17,000. By the way, I had saved up. You know, when you're in a combat unit, what ends up happening is you spend a lot of time in the field. So all my checks were getting banked. I really didn't have to spend too much money. Beer's cheap on the PX. You know, I really didn't have any expenses. And so I had a lot of money. We bought this boat. We move out here, and we found out what $17,000 worth of boat is, right? Not much. $50,000 later, it was a beautiful boat. But day one, it didn't really look too good. And we went to work restoring this boat. We spent the next year living in Marina Del Rey, restoring this boat and drinking every day. And now, I'm going to flash back a little bit. There were some other substances that were introduced to me, little white powders and things like that, that were popular in the 80s. That's cocaine for you who don't know. And I liked that. I loved it because it allowed me to drink more, right? And so we reestablished that connection when I got to Los Angeles. And they used to have this thing called freebasing, where you would cook up the cocaine and smoke it through a pipe, and you'd go to the club and it would be a great time. And we were doing that. And we ran out one day, and this guy that was on my boat, to this day I couldn't pick him up out of a lineup if you paid me. But he said, you know, you don't have to go through all that work. They sell that stuff right down the street, all cooked up already. That's crack, if you know, you don't know. And so the adventurer in me wanted to go try it, and I did. And boy, thank God for drugs, because it brought me to my knees really, really quick. You couple it with my drinking, and right down the hill, right? I could have probably drank for another, you know, however many years, but you add that on top of it, and boom, right? About 6 months later, after I lost the boat and was on whatever girlfriend, I found myself living in a crack house in North Hollywood, California. And my drinking was so out of control that all the crackheads that lived in the house got together and kicked me out because I'm an alcoholic. Now, if that doesn't qualify for me to be at this podium, I don't know what does, but you got to be in some pretty bad shape when the crackheads tell you you got to go because of your drinking, right? And how that all came about was, they were honest crackheads, and no, they weren't really. And they would go out and hustle all day long, and then they would meet at night, and they would pool their money and buy in bulk, right? And everybody would get an equal share. But I'm an alcoholic, so I can't put it all in, because tomorrow morning when I wake up, I'm going to shake. And I'm going to need a drink to get any type of hustle going whatsoever. I'm going to need that. You know, I love in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous when Bill Wilson goes through his stages of drinking, where he says, you know, in the midst of the excitement, I found alcohol. That was my story. The basement parties in Boston, the football games in Texas, under the bleachers. It was exciting. It was fun. And then he says he gets stationed over there, and out of loneliness, he turned to alcohol. And I could relate to that, you know, being in my room, isolating, and having a bottle under my bed that I hid from my mother, because I could, you know, I had to be very sparing with my booze. And then it says, liquor ceased to be a luxury and became a necessity. And this is the stage I was at. It was a necessity. I had to have that alcohol. Well, one of those crackhead girls saw me in the liquor store the next day and went back and told the rest of them. And they said, hey man, you know, you ain't an honest crackhead, you gotta go. And on that day, it was November, I can't remember what year, but it was in November because it was close to Thanksgiving. And my life that kid that came from all the opportunity in the world. I was walking down a street called Burbank Boulevard in North Hollywood, and I had a trash bag full of dirty clothes. I had 3.5 cigarettes. I know that because, you know, you had to count your cigarettes and kind of space them out. You didn't know when the next pack was coming. It was one of those California gray, dreary winter days. The air was wet, and for the first time in my life, I had nowhere to go. There was nobody to call. There was nowhere to go. And I really just didn't know what to do. And I started to pray. And my prayer to the Creator of the universe was just like this. I'll never forget it. I said, please, God, please let me find $10 so I can get a pack of cigarettes and a bottle of vodka. Spiritually, that's where I was. I'm talking to the Creator of the universe. And the best thing I can come up with is, can I please have $10? And, you know, God in His infinite wisdom didn't give me the $10. But when I lifted up my head, I had got a couple DUIs back in the day. And one of them, I went to this Alano club and I got it signed. And, you know, I figured that out, right? Well, if he can sign it, I can sign it. So I did the rest and turned it back in. They weren't too severe back then. And I remembered that Alano club was right around the corner. And I walked to that Alano club because I remembered they gave people free meals that needed something to eat. And it's kind of weird when you come off a good run and you realize you haven't eaten in a few days, you know. And I was hungry. And I went to that Alano club and I walked in and there were two old timers sitting at the table. A guy named Max and a woman named Alabam. And Alabam was kind of an iconic figure in the San Fernando Valley recovery circles. She passed away sober with, you know, 200 years of sobriety or something like that. But Max said to me, he said, you look a little beat up. Are you ready to surrender? And I looked at him and I said, yes, sir, I am. And Alabam goes, oh, Max, he's not ready. And I'm like, what? He goes, look, he still has a watch. Now, see, I didn't understand what that meant back then, but I know today. See, if I got a watch, that means I'm just a little better than the guy who doesn't have a watch. Right? I still got some kind of hustle left. I still think I'm cool. I still got something that my disease will tell me everything can be okay. Right? And you know what? Alabama wasn't wrong. I stayed around Chandler Lodge for probably 11 months. And right before that year, I relapsed. You know, now in the beginning I was going strong, meeting every day, sometimes two, sometimes three. In the very beginning I just stayed at the thing and went to every meeting they had. And my life got really good. I call it the bounce back. I had the unique ability to bounce back. And all of a sudden I got my job back. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous sold me a car with like zero down and $2 a week or some ridiculous thing like that. And so now I'm driving. I got my license back. I got the girl. She's coming up on 5 years. I mean, this life is looking good. I'm living in a sober living. And I'll never forget this. Me and this girl, we decided to move in together. No, let me rephrase that. I decided to move in with her. And we went to Big Bear one day. And on the way up to Big Bear, she looked at me and she said, you know, you're acting like a real ass. What is your problem? And I looked at her dead in the eye and I said, you know what? I'm not done. And she said, what do you mean you're not done? I said, I don't want to live my whole life and go to Monday Night Football and not have a beer. I don't want to go out for tacos and not be able to have a margarita, like I could afford a margarita, right? I don't want to, you know, I'm not done. And her, with 5 years of sobriety, looked at me and said, me neither. And we went right over that hill and down into Big Bear to the first bar we could find, you know? And that started a progression of relapsing for me that didn't end until I was 40 years old, but I regress. I don't want to go there yet. I got arrested for another DUI probably about 90 days after that first drink. And of course, you know, when I drink, I do things that aren't conducive to having a healthy relationship. And when they lock you up, they forget to shut your mail off. So like your phone bill still shows up and the credit card that shows you've been out to dinner and not with her and, you know, all these things. So when I got released from jail, I walk around and my car is packed with all this stuff, and she's got in soap cheater and loser and all this stuff, and she's gone back to AA and packed my fish tank with the fish tank in it in the car with the fish in it, right? Which leaves a lovely aroma after a few days in county jail, right? And so here I am driving my fish-smelling car full of all my clothes down the street, and again find myself with nowhere to go. And once again, I do what I do best. You know, I turn to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, there's a thing about the guilt and shame of people who relapse who have to come back in and stand up and take those newcomer chips. And if you're one of those people who comes in and you feel the guilt and shame, like, oh my God, I let this guy down, and I, you know, good. Because I'm going to tell you what worse than that. When you get to a point in your alcoholism when you can come in and take a newcomer chip and not care what they think about you, not have any guilt and shame, you got real problems. Because what happened to me was Alcoholics Anonymous became part of my relapse. In the back of my mind, I knew that when it got bad enough, I'd just go get sober again. You know, and that turned into treatment center revolving door. What would happen is I would make a decision. I don't have, by the way, I'm just one of those alcoholics, I don't have triggers. Right? I just don't have them. I'm at least that honest with myself to know that it's not a trigger is the reason I'm going to go out and throw my life away. I already know the consequences of my drinking. A Led Zeppelin song is not going to make me take a drink. Right? It's just not. Her leaving me is not going to make me go take a drink. The only thing today that's going to make me drink is that I want to drink. I want to. And I know the consequences of me drinking. I got so brutally honest with myself during one of my relapses. I sold my car before I drank. Okay? I had a history of always giving it to the dope man after I've been drunk enough. Right? Here, you give me a little dope, I'll give you my car. So this time I say, well, that's a bad business idea. I'll go sell the car first, then I'll have my drink, and I'll get full value for the car. That's where alcohol took me to, right? Because I got tired of getting beat up on it. See, and you know, that's a really dangerous place to be, because you play that kind of Russian roulette. And I can tell you from my experience, I know a lot of guys that don't make it back from those runs. And you know, just playing that game over and over and over again, thinking that you can always come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, or you can always check yourself into treatment and get right. Man, I've been to too many funerals to know today that that game usually just doesn't work out well. Well, anyway, I get sober, meet the girl, go to Big Bear, relapse. Over the next probably 10 years, I went to work for boating companies. I worked for Sea Ray and Wellcraft, and I was selling yachts, and I was really good at it. I was talented. You know, when you look at the talent pool that's in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's overwhelming. We do things really good when we want to do them. And I was making a lot of money. I met a nice Christian woman. I got married. I had a condo in Monrovia. She had a little 9-year-old daughter, my stepdaughter Amy, and I was playing the role of stepdad and sober member of AA and doing the things. And one more time, I made a decision that now I want to drink. Not now I can drink more. I want to drink. Look at all this money. This is a waste to have this much money and not put a buzz on top of it, right? Because for a normal person, success is good enough. See, I'm an alcoholic. I need success plus. Right? I need success plus. I need the turbocharged success, right? And I relapsed with her, and she put me in these fancy rehabs because we had great insurance. I went to this place called Las Encinas in Pasadena. They had tennis courts and golf courses and a swimming pool. And the lady would come wake you up, and she'd say, Mr. Prentice, it's time for group. And I'd say, I don't want to go to group. She said, well, would you like another Librium? Yeah, Librium. Librium will work. And, you know, I went to those type of places. And over and over and over and over again, I probably went to every rehab in Southern California. And at the same time, I started going to jail like that. I think my record says I was booked into Los Angeles County Jail 17 times. To give you kind of an idea of, I just wasn't an effective driver. You know, drinking and driving just did not work for me. And I'm kind of getting a little scattered here, so let me put it back on track. So I'm living in this condo with this woman, and toward the beginning of the end of my drinking, what happens is I'm on probation in Pasadena, I'm on parole in Los Angeles, and I'm fighting an 11-year case in Santa Barbara for assault and battery on a district attorney. That's what my life looked like. And I get this phone call from a lifelong friend in Dallas, Texas. Her name was Sherry. And Sherry listened to my whole story. I hadn't talked to her in about 10 years. And out of the blue, I get this call. And Sherry listens to my whole story, and she's brilliant. This woman is brilliant. She says to me, she says, "Well, David, you're not from California. Why don't you just come home?" And you know, that made a lot of damn sense to me in that moment. It made a lot of sense. So what? I'm on probation and parole. It's time to go home. Right? So what? I'm supposed to be in court Monday. Let's go. And so I withdrew all my money from the bank. I got in my truck and I headed to Dallas, Texas. Now, I shouldn't have known something was up. I gotta preface that. That day that she called, I had just relapsed. So I had alcohol and drugs in my system, and the parole agent came to test me. And he didn't have a test kit with him, so he took my urine and he went back to the office to test it. So he knew I was loaded, I knew I was loaded, and he knew he was coming back to get me and send me back. And I knew he was coming to get me, and that's when the phone rang. Right? Cunning, baffling, and powerful. And so I get to Dallas, Texas, and my best friend in life has a life that's worse than mine. Imagine that. Her husband has left her, taking the children. The house is in foreclosure. There's scattered furniture everywhere. And I fit right in. And I bummed around in Dallas, Texas for a few weeks, and then we decided to go on a road trip. Again, money wasn't a problem. I had taken all the money out of the bank. And so we decided we were going to go to Maine for lobster. Now, where that comes from is when we were kids, I used to talk to her on my summer vacations and say, "Oh, yeah, we're having..." And she always wanted to do that. And so I said, "Okay, well, let's go to Maine for lobster." And we drove this entire country in a Ford Explorer, partying our butts off. For anybody who says, you know, you can't have fun while drinking and using, we had a blast. We had a blast. And we went to all these little hole-in-the-wall bars. As long as it didn't have windows, that was the place we picked, right? All the bars with no windows. And we had an awesome time. And we went to Maine for lobster. We turned around and we decided to come back. And that day I had a conversation with her. And I said, "You know, we're going to have to settle down. We're going to have to settle down and pick a place, because we can't just keep staying on the road and keep driving around like this." And I went across the street, she stayed in the motel, and when I came back to the motel, she had taken all of her psych meds and killed herself. In the hotel room. In the hotel. That's alcoholism. It's alcoholism. What had happened to her was, I still had a part of my soul that wanted to have some kind of life, but she had given up hope. For her, that was her swan song. That was her way out of this whole miserable existence. And when I came back, and she was already blue, she was already dead. And here's the other part about alcoholism. I'm selfish and self-centered to the core. This is my best friend now, laying on a bed, dead in a motel room in a town called Bear, Vermont. And the best I can do is let her mother know where the body is, get in my truck, and go down the road. I can't call the police. I'm a fugitive. I'm a fugitive, and if I call the police and they ask me for an ID, guess what? They're going to put me in handcuffs and send me back to California on a bus. And I'm an alcoholic who's going to need a drink in a couple of hours. That can't happen. That was not even an option. That is the depths that drinking takes me to on a spiritual basis. I wouldn't do that to my worst enemy today. Just leave a body there. But I had no choice. Alcohol had already destroyed that whole thing of you actually have an option. Right? No option. I get in my truck and I head on down the road. But I don't know where I'm going. Well, during our travels, we had come into this one bar. in a little three-stoplight town in Illinois called Troy, Illinois. And in Troy, Illinois, we ran into a bar called The Empty Bottle. And at The Empty Bottle, I met the owner of the bottle. Her name was Penny, and Penny kind of took a liking to me. Now, just to put this in reference so you understand, I wouldn't introduce Penny to anybody in this room, right? I certainly would not acknowledge that I know her. But when you're drinking, you got to do what you got to do. And I had no more options. And while I was there, Penny had made me an offer. I don't know why I told her what was going on with me, but I had told her what was going on with me. And she said, David, if you ever want to come back to Troy, I'll sell you half the bar for $30,000. You can live here in Troy, Illinois. Nobody looks for anybody in Troy, Illinois. And so that kind of stuck in my head. And back to Troy I went. And, you know, Penny and I had a wonderful love affair. And she took my money and sold me half the bar. And life got good again. Life got good again. The great thing about Troy, Illinois, this is Bible Belt country. I mean, this is straight country. And if any of you guys ever heard of the country singer Gretchen Wilson? Right? She did a song called Redneck Woman a while back. Well, her father was our house band. Right? So that's the kind of country I'm talking about. And no drugs. In Bible Belt country, you can drink all you want, but there are no drugs. And you know what? I'm a great functioning alcoholic. And slowly my life turned into this. I would get to the bar at around 7 in the morning with the shakes a little bit, and I would drink Grey Goose and cranberry. I'd get that first one down. And for me, I could always tell where I was in life by the brand of vodka I was drinking, right? If I was doing good, it was Grey Goose. If I was doing not so good, it was that plastic bottle of pop-off for $3.59. You guys know the one I'm talking about? Right, yeah. And so I'm in the bar, I drink my Grey Goose and cranberry, I get that first one down, and then I sip vodka and cranberry till 12 o'clock. And the cook comes in, and I have my one meal of the day, a hamburger and garden salad, and then I switch to beer. I drink beer from like 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, and then I take a two-hour break at home, go home, take a shower, put on my cowboy boots and my leather jacket, and come back to be the bar owner at night, and I switch to Southern Comfort on the Rocks, and I drink that till 2 o'clock in the morning. Then I go home, pass out for 5 hours, get up at 7 with the shakes, and go back and do it again. And I live like that for a year, and that was not being sloppy drunk. That was just what was required to maintain any type of decency and have a conversation with my customers. That was just a normal day of drinking. And I'll never forget this. One day, I'm out there shoveling snow, and this guy walks up, and I had forgot to lock the front doors before we opened, and I walk out of the storeroom, and he's standing at the bar, and he goes, "Excuse me, fella, but do you think you could front me a couple beers till tomorrow?" And I'm like, wait a second, man. A, we're not open. B, I don't know you from Adam. And C, we don't do credit here. Get the out of here. And so he turned around to walk out. And what I saw not on his face was not that look of somebody who wanted a drink, but that guy who needed a drink. And I knew it. And I said, "Come here, man." And I sat him down, and I probably gave him a six-pack of beer, and he sat at the bar quietly and drank it. Well, the next day, that guy came back. Only now he was shaven, and his hair was nice, and he was, you know, real, real presentable, and he paid off the tab. And he, you know, we're sitting there early, and he says, "Hey, you get high?" And I went, "What?" He goes, "You get high?" He goes, "Here." And he's, year I haven't done any drugs. My life's going, you know, just drinking and blah, 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 blah. Here come the drugs again. It's almost like they just find you, right? The demon comes looking for me. "Dave, where are you?" And the next day, the bar doesn't open on time. Because Dave's stuck at home. I'm stuck. I am stuck, man. The phone's ringing off the hook. I pick it up, throw it into the wall. We got no time to listen to that. My customers are like, you know, just, it was all bad. And that really kind of started the beginning of my road to recovery. Because in that moment, wow, it's a long time ago. In that moment, I am sitting cross-legged in a trailer in Troy, Illinois. It's 30 degrees below zero outside. It's 110 inside the trailer. So the condensation and the moisture is all over the windows, right? I'm sitting cross-legged in a pair of old boxer shorts with pornography playing on the television because I got nothing better to do, right? And I realized that I was going to die. And I realized I was going to die just like my father had died. I was drinking myself to death. And I also knew in that moment that nobody was going to come to my funeral. I did a quick inventory of my life, and what I found was that nobody who came to my funeral would have anything decent to say about me anyway. Now, after all those rehabs, after all of those things, I knew what to do, but I still didn't want to do the work. So instead of going to AA, I went to the church. And I talked to the pastor, and I told him what was going on with me. And he goes, "Son, I can't help you." He said, "AA's right down there. You need to go talk to those people." Now, how's that for a God shot? Right? Because most pastors will tell you, you can exude that thought. He said, you know, he's like, "No, God created that for you, man. That's where you need to be." And what he really was saying was, "I don't want you around my congregation. Go down there," right? I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for the first time in my life, I took this program seriously, and I did everything you asked me to do, not just part of what you asked me to do. I had a program a while back. I did steps 1, 2, 3, 9, and 12. Right? That was my program. And usually by the time I got to 12, I was on a bar stool trying to help the guy who was drunk next to me, right? This time I did the steps in order, and when I got to the ninth step, that anxiety started to set in, and I realized I was a fugitive. And then at any given moment, all it was going to take was a traffic stop, and I was going to be put in those handcuffs and sent back to California. They ask in the big book, what lengths are you willing to go to, right? And so with 9 months of sobriety, I turned myself into the state of California and came back out on my own volition to do 4 years in the Department of Corrections as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not as a fugitive who got caught on the road. That's a hard thing for a drunk like me to do. But what I did was I made a decision that I was going to live according to the principles and traditions of this program while I was in prison. So I went, got a sponsor on the prison yard, started sponsoring men on the prison yard. I became a secretary of the AA meeting on the prison yard I was at. I went back to school and got an associate's degree while I was there. I became a clerk in the chapel at Tehachapi State Prison. I did my time, and when I was released, I turned myself into a sober living to reconnect with society through Alcoholics Anonymous rather than trying to run the show myself. I came out, got a certification as a drug and alcohol counselor, and started counseling people, not in Malibu, where I like to go to rehab. I went to Skid Row, and I got a job at a place called the Midnight Mission. It's on 6th and San Pedro in downtown Los Angeles. It's ground zero for alcoholism and drug abuse. 2 years later, they promoted me to program manager, and I became the program manager of a 250-bed men's residential drug and alcohol treatment program. And I bought all those tools that I had learned all those years of going in and out of rehabs and in and out of programs. I bought them with me. I knew what worked and what didn't work for me, and I started to put it in place there, and the program really took off. And 3 years ago, they called me in and they asked me if I would leave counseling to go downstairs and become an executive and work in philanthropy so that I could explain to people what we do. And that's what I do today. I'm the associate director of philanthropy for the Midnight Mission. Me and my team have to raise a total of $8 million a year without any money from the government because my rehab is self-supporting through its own contribution, just like Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to be. All of that is due to these people. You people. Right? Life is a lot different. I want to share the biggest miracle that's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. About 2 years ago, through a series of events, I found that woman who put me up for adoption. It was 50 years ago. And we met on my 51st birthday in Boston, Massachusetts. She was living in West Virginia, and we met, and I get the opportunity to make a living amends to her for the way I treated that woman who adopted me so many years ago. I get to be a good son today. We talk every single day. She talks to my girlfriend 5 times a day. And they all keep tabs on me, and they all make sure that David's doing what he's supposed to do, meaning, did he go to his meeting? Right? Is he doing the deal? And, you know, that's not the miracle. Finding my mom and reconnecting with my mom isn't the miracle. Here's the real miracle, and here's what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. When I found my mother, I realized that she was 70 years old and, you know, had a little place, very modest means. I was able to buy the airplane ticket to fly her to Boston to be reunited. I was able to fly her out to California to be able to spend holiday. I showed up and didn't ask for anything. I brought something to the table. I gave her a son that she could be proud of. And what I really gave her was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't show up saying, Mom, you owe me, or Mom, I have a resentment against this, or Mom, no, Mom, what can I do for you? Let me get that dinner for you. You sit down. You relax. I'll get the coffee. That's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the real miracle. That self-centered, ego-driven person that came in here just wanting to take from you, you loved until I was able to give back. So when somebody says, why are you going to Porterville? Man, if you only knew. Hey, you know, it's L.A. That day, it's like, wait, where? Listen, I already know the gifts that I get by coming to Porterville. Having a conversation with Brent and Cheryl and Bill and Carl and the other Cheryl last night, that's priceless. Those are memories I'll never be able to get back. And if I'm ever in this area on my way to Sequoia or up north or whatever, I know to schedule that trip around this meeting so I can come back and see some of you folks. That's the beauty of our program. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to thank you for paying attention to me. God bless you, and see you next time.